first, a word from our sponsors at Signature Books. The Tanners, a phrase sure to strike righteous fear in every good Mormon. But who were Gerald and Sandra Tanner? While some may view Gerald and Sandra Tanner only as despised critics of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, it is impossible to trace the course of Mormon history over the past 60 years without acknowledging their contribution. Many, both inside and outside of Mormonism, respect them for their unflinching quest for truth, no matter the cost. As when Gerald declared Mark Hoffman's notorious Salamander letter a forgery months before some experts declared it authentic. Their Utah Lighthouse ministry has operated for decades only blocks from church headquarters, where their many works on Mormonism are still printed and sold. Gerald died in 2006, but Sandra continues to oversee the ministry. The Tanners consistently challenge the church's position on many historical issues. Utah Lighthouse was long the only source for Mormon scholars to obtain certain crucial historical reprints, which they still happily or begrudgingly purchase. For others, the Tanners' writings have been the source of disillusionment with the church. Despised or beloved, the influence of Gerald and Sandra Tanner cannot be underestimated or ignored. Lighthouse, Gerald and Sandra Tanner, Despised and Beloved Critics of Mormonism, by Ronald V. Huggins, new from Signature Books. Available at Benchmark Books or wherever you get your books.
Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners, from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
Judson Tolman, Bountiful, Utah. My dear brother, these presents will summon you to appear before the Council of the Twelve Apostles in our room in the Salt Lake City Temple at 11 o'clock a.m., Monday, the 3rd, instant, to show cause, if any you have, why you should not be excommunicated from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints for marrying a wife illegally and in defiance of church discipline, and for performing such marriages for other parties. Fail not to come, as we shall be there in hear your defense, and to take such actions as the evidence shall warrant. I am your brother, Francis M. Lyman, in behalf of the council.
We're watching the saddest thing that can happen. They're seeing the sinner as he died.
Welcome back, friends, to what used to be the Sunstone History Podcast, but now has become the Mormon TV Review. Okay, listen, we'll make a deal. If these people will quit making Mormon series, then we can go back to the succession crisis. We left Sidney Rigdon there just hanging in the dark. But let's be honest. Brian Buchanan has been itching since we started the podcast to talk about Mormon fundamentalism. In fact, he's found a way to weave it into almost every episode.
I cheat. I'm not going to lie.
So it's summertime. It's hot Mormon summer, and we're letting Brian give us a little bit of his showing a little ankle, if you will, talking about all the fundamentalism. So yes, we're going to talk about Mormon fundamentalism TV series now. We just did Under the Banner of Heaven, and now we're back to Mormon fundamentalism. And we are here with our good friend, Dr. Christina Rossetti. Christina, will you remind the nice people who you are?
I'm Christina, back to talk about fundamentalism. I am an assistant professor at Utah Tech University. I write a lot about Mormon fundamentalist history and doctrine, and my book on Joseph Messer is, it's coming. And sometimes I hang out with Brian and Lindsay in the desert.
All it is you and I talking about when our book is going to be out someday.
Fresh off our banner high, we are shifting now to talk about the hottest new thing on the streams. Keep Sweet, Pray and Obey from the good folks at Netflix.
So I have to tell you, if our audio sounds different today, we're coming at you live from Southern Utah. We're sitting in a room. It has been a long day, folks. So we are very silly. And no, it's not the cinnamon toast milkshakes that Brian has made. It is the fact that Christina probably has heat stroke. I've got sunburns. And Brian, you guys, is in a tank top. That's the kind of day that we're having. We just ate some good DoorDash. We've been sitting in the cold because we had an adventure today. When we podcast for you, good people of podcast land, we do it hardcore. We decided, why not come down to Southern Utah, the belly of the beast, talk to people that are involved in this. We're doing a thing for Sunset tomorrow night, hanging out with fundamentalists of all stripes. And we thought we'd record while we were all together. Sounded like a good idea, right? So, Brian, how did it start out?
Lindsay's like, well, we need to do something before we record. What if we go to a ghost town? I'm like, I've spent nights in ghost towns. Let's do this.
And I want to point out that it's a Catholic ghost town. It's one of the only cities in Utah.
Partially.
Okay, never had an LDS meeting house.
Take that, Protestants. You just got moved out of Silver Reef.
Never had an LDS meeting house. Did have a Catholic church. So, okay.
Is it there, Christina? Is it still standing?
Here's the thing. So we had a list of ghost towns. We're like, let's look at the options. And we decided we're in St. George right now. Let's go to Silver Reef. Now, if you know where Silver Reef is, it's pretty close. It's pretty close to St. George. We thought, you know what? We'll go there in the morning, take the kids to the pool. During the afternoon, Brian brought his kids. I brought my kids. Big old family fun time. We all fit in the minivan and decide to head on our way to Silver Reef. Christina's excited because, as she just mentioned, she can't help mentioning, by the way, inserts it into every podcast. Yes, she's a Catholic talking about Mormonism. And happy day. We went to a Catholic mining town, a Gentile town, one of the very few towns in Utah that didn't have an LDS church, did have a Catholic church. And so Christina said, hey, let's go to the Catholic cemetery. So we do. Little dirt road.
Just drove right by the Protestant cemetery. Didn't even glance at it.
As you do. The reformers had their day in the sun.
As one does.
As we all had our day in the sun today.
Tell us about the chapel.
It's gone.
It burned. Satan won.
So we get in the car. Long story short, it's a very long story. We got high-centered in our minivan. It was a day.
Whoa. High-centered makes it sound simple. Take high-centered and high-centered in a amorous relationship that have children. That was the result what we got today.
Yeah, I'm not going to go into the particulars of who did this or how it was done, but let's just say it happened. And I was called back to the minivan by some frantic people. We're stuck. I was like, oh, I've been down to the creek. I can handle this. I could not handle this.
Lindsay calls me. It's bad. It's really bad.
So now we're stranded. It's 11:30 in the morning. We're still doing okay. It's not the high noon yet. Getting close. And we are digging out with sticks and old mining pie tins and fence posts. That's not doing the trick. So I put a call on Facebook and the response was great. We had Matt Riley come up from St. George. He's a great Mormon guy, very involved in Sunstone. He's hanging out with us on our Sunstone stuff tomorrow. He comes out to help, can't help us. It was too bad. So we have our fundamentalist friends come down from Hurricane. And I'll never forget the sight of this plural wife driving down the road in her big ass truck and just getting out. And I said, this woman, she's who you want to have during the end times on your team, because she comes out, starts digging, doing all this stuff. This woman knows her way around a carburetor. That's what I'm going to say.
When I think of the best of Mormonism, industry, self-reliance, this woman.
Yeah. And so she's helping us. They dig. We workshopped that for several hours. By this point, the kids have heat stroke. We have heat stroke. Brian takes the kids back.
Notice the gender roles here. Look how progressive this podcast is. I was on child duty. The two ladies working on the car in the desert. Thank you, Mormonism.
I'm not going to go into all of it. We weren't able to be successful, even though I've never seen a woman with such grit as this woman. Like, you should have seen her down there digging out my
minivan. It was a personal affront to her.
She gave me a little lecture on feminism and how women should be independent, and it was great. And so that happens, and then we have a desert mystic come and tell us that it's our fault because we're in a Catholic town. The Mormons never settled, and the curse of the Gadian robbers brought this on us. And you know what? I cannot disagree. Really felt like that.
I, too, actually can't disagree.
We have no data with which to argue.
So that is a long story short. No, really. I didn't do a good job of that. That is why we're silly and that's why we're tired. Matt Riley can tell you about how we met all kinds of characters today along our adventures. The FLDS women, the woman from Hurricane that taught us how to pronounce things correctly and open up a soda pop for him like a pro. It's been a day. So that is why we are here. That is why it sounds different. That is why there are children in the background.
It's like a flashback to Year of Polygamy. I like it.
I'm telling you, this stuff does not happen to me when I'm by myself, but when I get together with these yahoos, it's always this weird Nephite gold Gadian robber getting your car stuck in a silver mining ghost town kind of nonsense.
I'd just like to point out the only time I have slept on a trampoline as an adult was because of something that Lindsay invited me to, so I don't want to hear about it.
You guys are always blaming me, but it always happens when you're around.
I want to second that I also have slept on a trampoline because of Lindsay. Actually,
it's a pattern.
Does she need
it's
support?
A feature, not a bug.
Which year? Doesn't matter. I believe you. Listen, I have to say this about our adventures and Mormonism in general. Some of the best people are these Mormon fringe people, Mormon country folk, the Mormon rural people. I got called a townie more than I would like to admit today, and it's true, but there's something about rural mystic Mormon people that we got to experience today that was kind of beautiful. And it's interesting, as we're talking about Mormon fundamentalism, I'm going to keep that in my heart today because, you know, we like to talk about fundamentalist belief and the FLDS, and isn't it so crazy? We hung out with several FLDS people today, and there's something about the desert magic that is real and tangible for them, and their religion, sometimes as misguided and even dangerous as we're going to talk about, can be. They're connected to the soul of the world through these magical beliefs. I mean, we were talking about changing the clouds and calling in the weather and all this kind of mystic, like, legacy type stuff today, just because of our minivan being stuck in the desert with all kinds of characters that walked into our life today. And it's just a good reminder of the complexity in what we're talking about. Fundamentalism can be very dangerous, but there's some really beautiful, like you said, industry, something about it. Before we get into the deep doctrines of the series, and remember, there have been several fundamentalist series that we're going to talk about. Like we did with Banner, we thought we would do an intro episode setting the stage because we're going to be talking about several different fundamentalist shows out there. If you haven't watched them, just skip along and go back to Succession Crisis. Because Brian has been itching for this. He wants you educated and updated on fundamentalist history, and it's important. I would rather we wait, you know, two centuries till we get there.
2047?
But you know what? It's hot Mormon summer, so we're going to talk about it now. So we're going to give you sort of an intro, and we'll fast forward through the 19th century credits and get to where it starts to get good. The Second Manifesto, 1904. In just a minute, that is.
Remember that after doing polygamy for a good 50 years, Mormons were about to be sued out of existence. Something drastic was called for. Wilford Woodruff did his best field goal kicker impression and tried to steer the Mormon football right down the middle. What could he do that would satisfy the bloodthirsty forces trying to squeeze the life out of polygamy without, you know, giving up polygamy? The solution, of course, was the First Manifesto of 1890.
Now, you've all probably likely heard the ways that Woodruff's manifesto was later described, right? It's a revelation that officially ended polygamy. Judges? Yeah, we're getting thumbs down on both counts there. Sure, if your definition of revelation includes political negotiation, then great. But in the way that most Mormons then and now think about revelation, you know, the decisive, thus saith the Lord kind of animal, No. Woodruff's statement sounded like a press release. And there's a really good reason for that, because the statement was a press release. And it worked. The pressure did start to lessen. The following year, Woodruff and Company went before a specially appointed judge, said all the right things. You know, the manifesto prohibits polygamy everywhere, not just the U.S. Cohabitation with your previous wives, too? Nope. And anyone who tries any of this plurality business in the future is liable to get his butt excommunicated. And it worked. They got their stuff back. They were moving forward.
Only they didn't mean it. And this is really hard for people to wrap their minds around. One of the most pervasive themes running throughout the tapestry of polygamy is, well, what should we call it? Situational ethics? Semantics? Lying for the Lord, maybe? From the very beginning of Mormon polygamy, leaders had one message for public consumption and a very different type of behavior behind the scenes. Starting with the day that the manifesto was announced in General Conference in October 1890, plural marriages continued. Think about that. From the day the manifesto was announced, plural marriages continued right on. Sure, they might not have been quite as obvious, but pretty close. Bishops, stake presidents, apostles, heck, even Wilford Woodruff himself. Lots of people were getting married plurally, even the prophet. The women were in noticeable roles too. General board members, stake leaders, wives of mission presidents, that kind of thing. We've said it many times, here's another one for the road. Mormons are not great at keeping secrets. Sacreds, yes. Secrets, no.
As the 1890s went on, the public started paying more attention, as it became increasingly clear that the 1890 manifesto hadn't changed much, and then marriages were still happening, and people noticed, and we mean more than 200 of them. What was changing was public trust in Mormon leaders. Newspaper coverage became more and more cynical on the issue. When general authority and popular writer and speaker B.H. Roberts was elected to Congress, that was the straw that broke, what shall we call it? The pre-Columbian horse's back. Well, if at first you don't succeed, and millions of people protest? I don't know. Maybe try an apostle next time.
Honestly, if you did it right, this would all make a great series. Are you listening, Netflix and Hulu and Fubo and Shark Tank, all you guys? Reed Smoot was appointed to the Quorum of the Twelve in 1900. He wasn't particularly well known or liked or really much of anything. He was an up-and-comer. So he up and came to the ballot box. Except not really, because back then the state legislature elected senators, and they elected Elder Smoot. It really was quite the ballsy move, I have to say, because the B.H. Roberts gate was barely 5 years old. He was prevented from taking his seat in Congress. Why on earth would Mormon leaders think it would go any different this time?
Joseph F. Smith would remind you that when you remember the F, remember also that this guy didn't take any crap. He had a temper, never thicker than a pencil, however. Brian, why did you make me say that? Yeah, so here's the center of the matter. Joseph F. Smith, sitting in the red velvet chair, president's seat now, thought pretty much more than anything that Reed Smoot belonged in Washington, D.C. A few people disagreed, however. Like, I don't know, basically the entire country. They warmed up their vintage fountain pens again and signed millions of names to protest petitions and shipped them off to the congressmen. A lengthy series of hearings ensued back in the District of Columbia.
So once again, it was threat level midnight back at Mormon headquarters. One Mormon after another testified before the committee, and it wasn't great. It was pretty clear that they were evading using the "I don't remember" or "I don't know literally anything about what you're asking," or sometimes it was just basic perjury. Once again, something drastic was needed. When in doubt, write a manifesto. This time, threats of church discipline were actually written into the text of the so-called Second Manifesto of 1904, and this time, they actually meant it. Just, you know, not quite yet.
From 1904 on, it really starts to get murky. As you get closer to the Second Manifesto, it becomes increasingly more cloak and dagger. We get stories of people getting married while riding around in their fancy buggy in Liberty Park, no doubt ordered from the Sears and Roebuck catalog, like a normal person. Outside scrutiny really starts to focus on the guys most responsible for performing these marriages. You've got a few candidates to choose from, but it gets whittled down to two guys, John W. Taylor and Matthias Cowley. The homies back in Washington really wanted these guys to come back and spill the beans. And this is fun. In the latest Saints volume, we learn about John W. Taylor being asked to testify. There's been this story that I always felt smelled like folklore, that at the 11th hour, as he's making his way to Washington, John W. Taylor is called back by Francis M. Lyman because he has a dream that it's gonna turn out bad. So he catches him at the train station and says, no, you can't do this. It really sounded like apocrypha. Guess what? It's not. It's real. It comes from Francis Lyman's journal, and it's in the latest volume of Saints. Very, very interesting. So anyways, they want him to come back because they know they can spill the beans, but the church leaders in Salt Lake know this is a terrible idea. Even worse than, say, Joseph F. Smith having a baby during the hearings and getting a hefty fine for it. True story. Oh yeah, and part of the political maneuvers in the dark behind the scenes is that Taylor and Cowley are dropped from the Quorum of the Apostles after lengthy and heated discussions within the Quorum.
And I gotta say something, as an LDS person growing up, the surname Taylor was always familiar to me. Cowley, absolutely not. You hardly ever hear about this, and this is why they were apostles. And when they were dropped from the Quorum, I think the Cowley name especially, and we couldn't get rid of the Taylor name because we had John Taylor, his father. But at least for me, never even knew that Cowley was a Mormon name.
But even with Taylor, when did you ever hear about John W. Taylor?
Hardly ever.
Never.
Never.
And those two were so important and so pretty much universally loved at the time, which is interesting.
And really important in church history. So after the Second Manifesto, Taylor and especially Cowley slow down the polygamy train. Well, more accurately, they just hop off and talk to other people into being the conductors instead. Not being apostles anymore kind of leads to that, I guess. But there's a very murky network of other guys that start to develop. And Christina Rossetti is actually the expert on some of these networks. So her forthcoming works will be talking about this. But this network that starts to develop shouldn't surprise anyone. You can't preach that polygamy is necessary for exaltation for decades, backed by dubious eugenics that monogamists produce scrawny, weak children while polygamists produce nice, white, upstanding citizens to build the kingdom, and then just expect everyone to magically one day flip the switch. Doesn't work like that. Thanks, Heber Kimball, for your great theology.
So what happens? Patriarchs start to be a very important part of the story. For our non-Mormon listeners, my people, patriarchs are older men who are given the responsibility of giving people unique blessings that basically describe how their life will play out. Through some very creative theology, this morphs into authorization to perform plural marriages, sometimes based on nothing more than a wink from one of the apostles. Seriously, it's very loosey-goosey. One very important patriarch in this story is a guy named Judson Tolman. Picture a super old guy with an awesome vintage patriarchal beard. From about 1906, people start to come to him for under-the-table polygamous ceremonies. And this is where it gets interesting.
Every Friday on the farm is rabbit pie day, so every Friday that ever comes along, I get up early and sing this little song. Run, rabbit, run.
Showrunners, listen up again. Marriages are done in ice houses. Tolman is married by a guy in a mask.
Wait, and can we just talk about this mask for a minute? Because I've seen conceptions and drawings. This is like scary murder victim, like potato cellar mask sewed together with big stitches. Like, it's terrifying stuff. The stuff every little girl dreams about.
It's such a weird dynamic. And it's all of this is to ensure that the highest law will continue in ice houses with a mask.
You know what really brings out the higher law in people? A man with a gunny sack with two scary scarecrow eyes cut out over it.
Doesn't it seem a little Scooby-Doo?
It does.
Who's under that mask? Oh, I knew it. It's Mr. Judson Tolman.
I would have gotten to the Celestial Kingdom if it wasn't for these darn kids.
It's fascinating. And luckily, we only know about this because we were able to see the actual minutes from these trials. Because they bring them in, they start grilling them, and all these little fascinating details start to seep out.
If it happened today, what mask? Would it be like an Obama mask? Imagine, you know, those creepy like president masks that people rob banks in now? He's your patriarch. He's wearing Donald Trump mask.
Maybe if you had a guy with a particular affinity for history, he'd have like a Nixon mask, just a throwback.
Yeah, throwback, vintage style.
Ooh, he had a Dick Nixon mask. He must be a real history
No
buff.
Hillary Clinton, because no ladies.
No ladies, no. So yeah, all these things going on. You tell me, showrunners, that this doesn't make a great show. So Mr. Judson Tolman, this patriarch up in Davis County, he marries about 20 couples. Maybe some of them sent by Matthias Cowley. Again, this period is murky. We don't really know all the details that we would like to. Well, again, Mormons and crappy secret keeping comes back into play. The apostles are hearing lots of rumors going around. Only now, it's really time to quit doing polygamy. We're not doing crossies behind your back, none of this, it's opposite day, no psych, none of that. We mean it. And part of this is because the president of the Quorum of the Twelve is a guy named Francis Lyman, and he seems to have actually believed the public messaging that polygamy was really over. And this dude does not screw around. He's a big guy, he's got kind of a blunt personality. What he does, he appoints a committee of apostles to go after these guys doing polygamy. The question of whether he was doing this all on his own initiative or whether Joseph F. Smith told him to, encouraged him to, or whether Lyman just thought that Joseph F. Smith wanted him to do it is very unclear. We'd love to know more about that.
Wait, can I just say something about that? Because this reminds me of when we like to think of these men in the Quorum as like this united front, especially in the past, they all believe the same. We know about this now. We know that the apostles don't get along. Some have lifelong conflicts. Some compete over how many temples they're going to build until they're in charge and then they take over. People want to do their own thing and put their own thing. And I'm sure Lyman had this idea that polygamy was archaic and he wanted to push that through.
Some fight really hard for a long time to get rid of the word Mormon, and then one day they win
until the next guy comes along. That's the thing, right? That's these kind of struggles. This is how I interpret Lyman. I think he was a guy that thought it was archaic. He wanted to be modern. He wanted to be this modern Mormon church. If he were alive today, he would make everyone stop doing Boy Scouts and join activity days. I don't know.
Lyman is a really, really interesting man. Part of the problem with understanding Lyman is his diaries are still not quite available for research. We're making progress. The fact that they are, A, no longer in the First Presidency's vault, because nothing is in the First Presidency's vault from what we understand, and B, the Saints team had access to them means that we're getting closer. So if and when we can access his diaries, we can answer a lot of these questions.
Wouldn't it be a scandal if they were hiding them or putting them in restricted because he secretly had plural wives? That would be a wild ride.
I would love it.
They're wherever John Taylor's diaries are. Bum, bum, bum.
We've looked and they don't exist.
Who was it?
Arrington. Was it Joseph F? It was Joseph Fielding. They exist, damn it. Nellie, we know.
There's a Nauvoo general. That's it.
Okay.
No
All
more.
Right. Continue on, sir.
So, not surprisingly, when these guys come in and they start getting grilled, these guys are very surprised because they realize, wait, they really mean it now. Because folks are now getting excommunicated. It's serious.
And no, it's not all nice and neat, as we were talking about. In one case, they bring in a guy and he promptly tells them that he was given permission to perform a marriage by church president Joseph F. Smith. Remember the F. That's a killer card to have up your sleeve in a church court. Oh, I'm sorry that I performed this illegal plural marriage that we no longer do, but the prophet told me to. This clearly throws the apostles for a loop because the guy seems to be telling the truth and no one really wants to walk next door and, you know, just ask Joseph F. Smith about it because probably they would know he was right. So this is no time to remember the F. You just ignore it and pretend it didn't happen. Well, okay, forget that guy then. Let's bring in this Judson Tolman guy.
And oh boy, Tolman is something. He's super old, as I've said twice now. And he gets confused. Again, he's really old. However, he's telling them quite a different story. It's even bigger than they suspected. They realize they have to get control of the situation. They excommunicate Tolman. No messing around. But Tolman's son really doesn't want his father to die like this, so pushes hard to get him reinstated. Gradually, the apostles are convinced he is remorseful and allow him to be rebaptized. But of course, there's some conditions. One of them is they need a list of everyone he marries. Names, dates, places. This is how we know about the ice houses. The list is very important because it's a roster of the key players in the unfolding drama. Some of these guys follow the Tolman path and return to full belief and activity in the LDS church. Some of them, though, will take a different path. A fundamentally different path, you might say.
Rimshot. Yeah, rimshot. On this handwritten list, we have a very simple entry. City, Jeff's, 1909. From that basic entry, however, we get a long, complicated, and painful history. Who was this guy? What would his 80 years on Earth mean for Mormon history? David William Ward Jeffs was born in Farmington, Utah in 1873. He has all the Mormon credentials. He's a third-generation Mormon, born to parents who converted to the faith in their native Britain. His father was an ardent believer in the principle, eventually marrying four wives. When David was 13, his father was nabbed by those filthy, filthy federal marshals on a polygamy charge, and he serves 5 months in the territorial penitentiary. Growing up around all these siblings and mothers, polygamy was just kind of the way Mormon life worked. At least if you want to be like God, that is.
So David lived a very typical Mormon, moving up at the priesthood rungs, existence. He served a mission to the southern states, just like John D. Lee. We don't know if he ever crossed paths with another missionary that was there named Joseph Musser, who was around tramping down in the south as well. But after returning to Utah, David married Phoebe Ann Woolley. You know, remember the W in 1900. It was a good catch for young David. Phoebe was the granddaughter of longtime bishop and quasi-folk hero Edwin D. Woolley. Her father's oldest brother, John W. Woolley, was a worker in the Salt Lake Temple and very well respected in Davis County. He was one of the witnesses at their sealing. Phoebe's oldest sister, Jeanette, known as Nettie, was married to charismatic apostle John W. Taylor. And sadly, we don't know much at all about Phoebe. Life seemed to follow the idyllic, well-worn Mormon path that they had four children together, all of whom thankfully survived childhood. One was named Alvin, another Velma, and they didn't even watch any cartoons.
David continued on the path, eventually being called to serve as counselor to the bishop in their Idaho ward. They stayed in Idaho until 1908 when they moved to Logan, then Salt Lake, back to Logan, back to Salt Lake, then Provo, so Phoebe could be close to her sister, Nettie. Remember, she's married to John W. Taylor. This is wild. According to David, Phoebe is the one that suggests polygamy. While they were living in Idaho, she said she had been, quote, shown that David was supposed to enter plural marriage and said Lenora Timpson was the one. Buckle up, kids. The relationships here are about to get tricky. Lenora was the daughter of John Timpson and Janetta Hamer. Janetta's mother, trying to make things work as a single mom, gave Janetta to a couple to raise. Her adopted father died, and then Janetta's mother married William Jeffs. So that makes David Lenora's uncle via adoption.
Which is super hot when you're dating someone to be like, I know I'm your uncle, but let's make out. It's a little different. David remembered an earlier prophecy that he would be, quote, inspired to enter into the law of plural marriage. So, how it works is Phoebe invited Lenora to their house in Idaho to have the talk. And she told Lenora she was fine with her marrying David. However, when Lenora's dad hears about this, he goes off and tells David's bishop. And this is interesting because he, John Timpson, had two wives and had children with both of them within the last couple years of this happening. So it is interesting that he would get so up in arms about it. He suspects that David had already married Lenora, with either David's father or John W. Taylor performing the ceremony. David isn't convincing enough, so he gets hauled into the stake president's office now. He again denies that they've been married, but when they ask if he still plans on living plural marriage, he says, quote, that depended on whether the Lord raised up the way, that I believed that the law was true, and if God inspired me to enter the law, I would. Just in case, if you're curious if this meeting affected him in any way, that night when he tells Phoebe what happened, he suddenly prophesies that the bishop will die.
The spiritual gifts hour isn't over. Later that night, he prays asking if it is truly God's will that he marry Lenora. He then has a vision of who will perform the ceremony, and it's Judson Tolman. Just for good measure, Lenora's mother also has a vision that confirms that this is the right course. I like it when people get to experience Oprah polygamy, and you get a vision. You get a vision. So they all start making preparations. Lenora goes to the Manti Temple and receives her endowment. And this step is actually a very helpful step in determining when plural marriages happen during this time period. David tells about asking Lauren Woolley, Phoebe's cousin, where to find Judson Tolman. According to David, Tolman, quote, came to me through the influence of the apostle of the Lord Jesus Christ, whose name I will not divulge. No worries, buddy. It's Matthias Cowley. We know, no need to get all agitated.
Jeffs later wrote that Judson Tolman got his authority from Joseph F. Smith and John W. Woolley. It's unfortunate that this is a reminiscent account because it makes our life harder. If it were contemporary, it would be the earliest account of John W. Woolley giving someone else authority to perform plural marriage. As it stands, keep that thought in the back of your mind. While they were considering adding Lenora to the family, they were also considering wife number three, Florence Tracy. You think info on Phoebe and Lenora was scarce? We're not even sure Florence Tracy is her real name. While you're feeling bad for Florence, add Phoebe in there. The second David married Lenora, he apparently lived mostly with her. So much for the law of Sarah.
As a result of all this living with Lenora, as usually happens.
Living with Lenora sounds like a Golden Girls spinoff.
It could be a spinoff.
I'd be into it.
Like, it would have like a mod kind of intro.
Someone needs to write that it's like Mary Tyler Moore walking down New York City with, confidence. But instead she's canning in her kitchen.
Watch the hell out of that. As a result of all this living with Lenora, the little Jeffses start coming along. The first of them, no one's ever heard of him. Rulon Jeffs, I guess was his name. Oh, I'm being told everyone on Earth has heard of him. Yeah. While Rulon was growing up, the Jeffs house was the place to go if you were an expectant plural mother. They apparently housed lots of them. He was quickly introduced into the need for secrecy. His birth certificate was full of made-up names, for example. According to Rulon, they went by Jennings until he was about 11. Now, he was exaggerating that at least somewhat, because they do show up as Jeffs, like normal, on plenty of records during the period. However, his younger sister, Leona, did appear as Leona Jennings on her birth certificate. That was fun to see. As a part of this subterfuge that's going on, they just didn't attend church to avoid attention.
Was he 11 or was he 9?
He says 11 in one account. He's probably told this story like 8 times, so he probably said 9 in the other.
What? Differing
one.
Accounts?
Different accounts
of Rulon's. Who does that?
First vision here. But according to him, he didn't even know his father was a polygamist until his half-sister Lucille came to live with him when he was 9. That may be what you were thinking of. Life in the Jeffs house wasn't always raspberry and cream, however. His youngest sister Arlene was born with Down syndrome, and they basically just shipped her off to the state to take care of. It's very sad.
It's a sin, my darling, how I love you, because I know our love can never.
Despite all the craziness and keeping things secret and who knows, maybe even occasionally sacred, Rulon did quite well at school. He was the valedictorian at his class at LDS High School. No, seriously, that was the name of the school, LDS High School. He's the valedictorian, gives a speech in the tabernacle, sharing the program with none other than James E. Talmadge. Talmadge wrote in his journal that night, quote, "As the young man began to deliver a speech, I felt a chill go up my spine and a voice said, 'There is a great disturbance in the force.'" Okay, fine, he didn't. But still, that's a pretty fun image comes to mind, and I wish he would have written it because maybe his books would be better. Talmadge and Rulon Jeffs on the same program? Interesting.
Just for the listeners to remember, at this point, Talmadge is the point man in the Quorum of the Twelve who's appointed to go after fundamentalists.
And sure, Talmadge and Rulon on the same program is great, but you know what's even better? He got the Heber J. Grant Award for a scholarship as a senior in high school. Rulon Jeffs got the Heber J. Grant Award.
That was in his history, and I said, please, please let this one be true. And it is. It's in the newspaper.
Yeah, I mean, you can't make this up. Rulon said that Helen Musser, daughter of the St. Joseph White Musser, also got that award that year, but he seems to be off there. Such a shame. After graduating from high school, he chose to work for that high school. Every kid's dream. It wasn't all bad news, though. While there, he met a girl named Zola. She was from a pretty posh family. Her dad, Hugh B. Brown, had been a stake president in Canada and was now a big-shot lawyer in Salt Lake City. His firm included J. Reuben Clark, soon to be a big deal, and Albert E. Bowen, later an apostle. Just as the sparks are starting to fly between him and Zola, a mission call comes.
Rulon gets sent back to his ancestral homeland of England, and the times were tough. Great Depression is just starting, and so David Jeffs is out of work. He's not really able to contribute to Rulon's mission fund, so he recorded a series of miraculous events throughout those 2 years that allowed him to support Rulon. Oddly, Ruland's history mentions basically nothing about that period. We do know he was there at the same time as some very entertaining folks. Cleon Skousen, for one. Milton Musser, son of Joseph White Musser and plural wife Ella Shipp. Frank Naylor, who later breaks with Ruland and the FLDS, lands in Centennial Park, and then starts an independent group with Ivan Nilsson. You also have Eugene Needham, who sold zillions of Utah State students their wedding rings. He unfortunately missed Gordon Hinckley, his classmate from LDS High School, by about a year in the mission field. When he gets back, he goes to Heber J. Grant's office to report his mission. He later said, quote, "I can't remember anything but a spirit of darkness in that office." Not that, you know, later events colored that memory or anything.
My favorite thing is they're always accusing the other person of having darkness in the room. It's like, that guy didn't have the spirit. No, he you didn't have the spirit
with him.
I have the authority. No, I have the authority. No, the man in the corn mask has the authority. That's you're the only one that laughs at jokes like that. Did we mention that the Great Depression was on? Because David and Ruland both tried to get jobs in California, and no word on whether they read Grapes of Wrath during the drive. Didn't work out, so Ruland returned to Salt Lake City, where he picked up his relationship with that flapper herself, Zola Brown. The courtship moved quickly. She apparently told him she was ready to get married. She was head over heels for him by all accounts. However, in Ruland's telling of how it went, they had a porch swing discussion about his father. She asked him point blank about polygamy, and his response, quote, "When the time comes and it is required of me, I expect to live it. That is a correct principle required to inherit the celestial kingdom, and I will live it when it's required." Very standard LDS response. According to him, she just didn't ever expect him to actually do it. It's a very LDS response, right? We always talk about growing up, like,
pretend it's not there.
It's not going to be there. If it's ever required, we'll do it, but they're never going to require it, will they, Zola?
When the happy day came, June 1, 1934, who performs their sealing in the Salt Lake Temple? None other than our guy, Heber J. Grant, with his flourishy John Hancock on the marriage license. Early married life was apparently quite idyllic. Ruland quotes from a letter from her that is all sunshine and Mormonness. She does counsel him against slang. Apparently, Ruland had been
Bumping gums about the G-men and mafiosos dueling with the Gats.
Apparently, he'd been bumping gums about the G-men and mafiosos dueling with the Gats. Who knows?
Bumping gums. Yeah, something like that. Then, the crucial moment. As Ruland tells it, he was at his father's birthday dinner in 1938 when David hands him an issue of Truth. Friends, this is a tale as old as time. Apparently, David had run into St. Joseph White Musser a year earlier. He described Musser as, quote, "an apostle writing for a group of people who are carrying on in the fullness of the gospel." Ruland then meets Joseph W. Musser and basically jumps in with both feet.
And yeah, sure. Meeting Joseph White Musser is all well and good, but where is the key holder here? Don't fret. Ruland soon got to meet John Y. Barlow. David Jeffs first pops up in fundamentalist circles in March 1938 at a meeting. He quickly becomes a trusted figure, and then he's appointed to supervise the missionary work, which is kind of interesting. Ruland Jeffs first shows up in an incredibly on-brand way, visiting Short Creek. He goes down there with Joseph Musser, John Y. Barlow, and the boys to see how the things were going down there. He and his father then frequently sang together in meetings. Now we know where Warren got it.
His body then will be renewed, restored as in his youth. His handmaid ends shall be increased, and great will be
any excuse to include that clip, I will happily take. When Ruland reflected on this period of his life, he declared, quote, "I cannot help but conclude that God has, as it were, had me in the hollow of his hand."
Where's Janice Cat Perry when you need her?
In the hollow of thy hand as he grows from boy to man.
You had no idea that song was about Ruland Jeffs, did you? Also, just because I find it amusing, Joseph Musser always spelled his name R-U-L-E-N. Love it. every time.
Very passive aggressive.
He could not spell his name. He could not spell Lauren Woolley's name.
So while the Jeffs family was certainly not Mormon royalty, I mean, they weren't like Lafferty's or anything. Too soon? I've had too many French fries today. They were connected to some degree. David met a friend on the street one day. Ruland thought it was a missionary companion, and he asked why he had apostatized. David's response was classic. Quote, well, let's put it this way. I have apostatized from the apostasy of the church. You have the authority. I have the authority. No, I have the authority. You lost the spirit.
You're an apostasy.
This is how that generation saw things. They didn't see themselves as a separate organization. They were the higher law department of the LDS church, the ones who were maintaining the principle instead of giving in like sissies. We need a like 1920s slang, mafia slang, but Brian didn't write that
like
line.
Like panty waists.
Panty waists. No, not like that. Anyone given in to the government.
Ruland didn't tell Zola about all of this at first. I mean, who would? He was attending cottage meetings and such. He waits to tell her until right after she gives birth to their second son. Great timing, bro. According to Ruland, she said she didn't want to hear any more about it. And girl, same. He keeps working on her, writes her a long letter, takes her to some meetings where she hears testimonies of plural marriage. She eventually makes the turn, and she says she'll accept it. And then her parents come home. Zina and Hubie Brown had been presiding over the British mission as World War II began. Zina came home first, and when she heard the news, squelched it. Then when Daddy returned, he put a complete stop to the polygamy talk. David had already been excommunicated, and the dogs were now after Rulin.
Rulin had been caught at the cottage meetings by the team of Fred Curtis, who Rulin called the Peeping Tom Bishop. If that phrase sounds interesting, oh man, it is. The Fred Curtis story is very fun. We will undoubtedly talk about that. So, church leaders start investigating Rulin, but his former mission president, A. Will Lund, who of course will later be the grouchy archivist at the historical department, asked them to hold up while he tried to straighten Rulin out. Rulin is finally given a loyalty oath to sign, which he was not happy about, and Zola keeps telling her parents details about the relationship, which pissed Rulin off even more. What he does is gives her a long list of scriptures to study about, quote, the order of the priesthood. It's not quite the peacemaker, but it's headed down that road. He warns her that John Taylor had told the dudes he ordained in 1886, quote, many of them would be handled, but woe unto those by whom it should come. He concluded this letter ominously, quote, I don't want my own wife to be in that position. In this letter, he set the theme for the next 70 years, quote, if I lose some things here, I shall gain eternal life for myself and those who will go with me.
And honestly, from this point forward, Rulin was all in. He tells of a visit to John Y. Barlow, Brian's favorite guy, who explained his connection to Lauren Woolley. He was ordained by his father and Joseph Musser, Christina's favorite guy. Musser also gives a patriarchal blessing. He blessed Rulin with the ability to convince Zola. Yeah, somehow that one didn't shake out so well. That didn't happen. According to Rulin, he came home one night to find Hubie Brown there with Zola in a meeting that can only be described as fun. Rulin was given a list of conditions to keep Zola. No more meetings with polygamists and no reading their literature. Always take Zola when he went to visit parents, go to church with her. No more giving money to polygamists and definitely no marrying anyone else.
That last one seems a little harsh.
A little harsh. And always feed her good Mexican food and never be angry before you go to bed.
No mayonnaise in the guac.
And let's just say that meeting went like this. He slept in the basement that night and moved out the next day, so went well.
Zola moves for a divorce quickly, and it's ugly. Rulin doesn't pay alimony, and he accuses her of taking it from his rental income without telling him. Okay. Her complaint outlines how he constantly told her his intentions to marry another wife, and that he had seen her in a vision. Zola said that, quote, the name of this woman rang in her ears until she thought she would go crazy. Rulin, for his part, gets somewhat creative. Zola's state of mind was due to, one, some operation she had before they were married, two, mental stress due to learning of certain unlawful acts of her father. See, Rulin later claimed that Hugh Brown was called to preside over the British mission because he had done some shady stuff as head of the Liquor Commission. Doesn't seem to be any evidence of that. Even though Utah's Liquor Commission, am I right? The court sided pretty much entirely with Zola, and then he was excommunicated 2 weeks later. According to Rulin, he was also given a loyalty oath to sign. Because, of course, it was Marion G. Romney as the stake president who excommunicated him. Romney, of course, was born in the Mormon-Mexican colonies because his grandpa went there to do the polygamy.
Isn't it wild, all the interactions of these guys? Their dads, their grandpas are all polygamous, and within a generation, they turn on a dime, and now they're going after him. This
really
period is fascinating.
Rebelling against their parents. Well, I actually think that that's fascinating because it shows how insular Mormon elite groups are, and they still are. Like, if you know people that are related to the general authorities, they all know each other. They're all cousins with everyone. They all grew up in the same neighborhoods. It was like that with this generation as well.
Which makes it very personal and very painful when they get excommunicated. And after that, that's it. Rulin is free of his last tie to institutional Mormonism. A year after the divorce, he married Kathleen Jessup, who's the daughter of Moroni Jessup. No, not that Moroni Jessup. And she's a cousin of Lyman Jessup. Rulin paints this as a placement marriage. In other words, she's made ready to the priesthood, and then Musser assigned her to Rulin Jeffs. And it's
worst
okay.
assignment ever.
And it's fine. Like, you're free to think that that's gross, because it is.
I'm also contesting the claim.
Placement marriages at this point in time are tricky because there's later claims that it's going on, but contemporary evidence is hard. Part of that problem is just because we don't have enough contemporary evidence. It very well could be true, but as of yet, we just don't know. Rulin also tells a story about Hubie Brown coming to his office and telling him if he just cut this polygamy stuff out, Zola would come back to him and quote, "I can promise you that you could become one of the general authorities of the church." Sorry, Uncle Rulin, not buying this story. Just a month after Rulin's excommunicated, two key figures are added to the priesthood council by John Barlow, Leroy Johnson and Marion Hammond. Rulin claims that Rulin Allred, another Rulin, and Lyman Jessup both sent a letter complaining that they weren't chosen. Sorry again, Rulin. I'm also not buying that story.
Well, you have to say something about Rulin Jeffs' history, and this is hard for our FLDS listeners, even our ex-FLDS listeners. Rulin Jeffs is not a reliable narrator about his own history, which makes it hard to parse out fact from fiction.
And in most places, his narrative is all we have.
Or his edited narrative.
Would be interesting. He refers to journals that his father kept. Those would be fun to see.
He also talks about how J. Reuben Clark sent him a letter saying he was called to disrupt the priesthood from the LDS Church. So, you know, he's got some stories. So Rulin tells a very odd story about how he was supposedly prepared to be on this council. He went with John Barlow, Joseph Musser, and his son Guy Musser up to visit other fundamentalists up in Idaho. Barlow is sick during the meeting, but gets up and announces to the group that they were ready to help Rulin and Guy Musser qualify. How so, you might ask? Well, to be an apostle, you have to have had at least three wives. And in addition to Kathleen Jessup, Rulin soon married LaRue Hunter and Ruth Jessup. And yes, Ruth is Kathleen's little sister. Next up was Rulin's first chance at real leadership. The 1944 raid took place just 4 days after he marries Ruth. Nothing like a good persecution complex to get things going. When they raided the priesthood home where Rulin and his wives were living, they found him with his first legal wife. So he was okay. He got out of the country, he got out of the county jail quickly, and then worked on collecting bail for everyone else.
It didn't go unnoticed. Just before the 15 men went to prison in 1945, Rulin was ordained an apostle. He and Guy Musser, also a new apostle, again were tasked with running things while the other guys were in jail. Rulin later argued that the only person who was loyal to John Barlow through this period was Leroy Johnson. And I will say, bummer to Brian and his boy John Y. Barlow, is that this is actually not surprising at this time, because around this time, Joseph Musser and Lewis Kelch go to John Y. Barlow. Lewis Kelch, for those unfamiliar, is the grandfather of the independent movement. They go to Barlow and point blank ask him, "Do you have the keys?" And Barlow, not one to lie, says, "No."
He doesn't say someone else has them.
He just says, "No." It's a great story. Anyway, so Leroy Johnson, though, still very faithful. Now, that might just have a little influence from later events. Just a smidge. Not surprisingly, Rulin also supported the decision to sign a manifesto to get out of jail. Not even a hint of irony that they had been complaining about Wolford Woodruff's manifesto for years.
What was that about that covenant with death and an agreement with hell about the manifesto?
Rulin, a Woodruff for another time, if you will. Well, manifesto gate aside, they got out, and absolutely nothing changed. Funny thing about manifestos, there was a very odd interaction with the LeBaron family in Mexico. Dare, father of the... I'm not going to say clan on that. Dare, father of the group, told the priesthood council he had land in Mexico he would turn over to them. Several went down, including Rulin Allred, who was jumping his parole, and experienced a gigantic fiasco. Surprisingly, the LeBarons were a little unstable. Dare decided he didn't really... I don't really want to say that. I'm going to use a different word. Is that okay? Surprisingly, things were starting to go awry with the LeBarons. Dare decided he didn't really want to give them his land, and also informed them he was the head of the priesthood. Neither part was well received.
After the 1945 prison experience, the seeds of schism were sown. It seems pretty clear that Joseph Musser had always had reservations about John Barlow's leadership. He passes those reservations on to Rulin Allred and others in the group. It was mostly under the surface, but by this point, after prison, it threatens to break into the open. And two big developments will really spur this change. The first is this concept of placement marriages. Again, there are some hints that maybe some of them were going on during this time, but they really take off as the 1940s turn into the 50s. One particular marriage between Louis Barlow, oldest son of John Barlow, and Louise Jessup, daughter of Winnie and Lima Jessup, caused some serious fractures. There's a really good article on this by Marianne Watson. On one side is her father, Lima Jessup, and also Joseph Musser. Musser, however, by this point is old and ailing, and he's really not given to public controversy. He just kind of lets things ride. On the other side of this, you've got Lyman's, basically his entire extended family, including his brother Richard, who performed the marriage, and like the rest of the community that was aware of it.
And the second and far more divisive matter was Rulin Allred, our other Rulin. You know, there's a lot of Rulins here. After years of John Barlow ordaining apostles without consulting anyone, Musser now appointed Rulin Allred as a high priest apostle and, more significantly, second elder. So in other words, his successor. The rest of the council opposed this move. The most vocal members insisted that Rulin had pulled a fast one on the ailing Musser. However, if you look at the relationship between the two, stretching back 15 years, it's clear that Musser had long respected Allred and wanted him where he was. I back that up. Do you back that up? Within a year, the split was final. The old council went their own way, and Joseph Musser began filling a new council with men like Margarito Bautista, Lyman Jessup, and the Allred brothers, Rulin and Owen.
The next 2 years were fairly murky for the old council. Charles Zitting was technically the head of the council, but he does not seem to have exercised much of a public profile, either in a more authoritarian way like John Barlow or a more charismatic model like Joseph White Musser. When Zitting and Musser died within months of each other in 1954, new eras began for both groups. Even before Zitting passed away, Leroy Johnson had been the de facto leader of the old council, particularly over the community at Short Creek. The infamous 1953 raid at Short Creek, when hundreds of police officers flooded the community in a public relations disaster, did nothing but solidify the community's identity as the Lord's persecuted people. There were a handful of convictions on polygamy charges over the next decade, but generally speaking, legal action against polygamists was over.
In the 1960s, the community at Short Creek, straddling the Utah-Arizona border, was divided into the incorporated cities, Hilldale on the Utah side, and then later, Colorado City on the Arizona side. At the same time, he had a healthy community of the old council adherents in the Salt Lake Valley, people like Rulin Jeffs, for example. And there were feelings going both ways. The Salt Lakers felt like they were more educated and refined than their southern colleagues, while the Crickers saw these city boys up there as weekend warriors who just did not experience all the privations they did and thus didn't get the same degree of righteousness. We start to have a lot better records of sermons from this point forward, and we can see some of the theological trends develop. And the distinctive dress also begins in this period, with dresses being basically a requirement.
After all the hubbub with the placement marriage of Louise Jessup, the concept became an identifying principle. Leroy Johnson would refer to it as the, quote, high and holy law that involved divine choosing. And it's pretty basic. If you let women choose a husband, they will probably choose to be the first wife of a man close to their age. We can't have that. If you want to perpetuate a polygamous system, that doesn't really work so well with those with that pesky 50-50 birth ratio. So placement marriages were a very effective way of ensuring that polygamy continued generation after generation. And I will say this about this too. There is a logic to it in the sense of polygamy is hard. We know it's hard for marriages. So if you assign people that aren't in love, then they come to it more equally in the sense of the then they don't have to share their jealousies and affections because
you
didn't like them in the first place. So given the amount of power that Leroy Johnson usually called Uncle Roy by the community, he's beloved by that community, Uncle Roy's beloved. Given the power that he held, it's surprising that he doesn't seem to have ever referred to himself as the one mighty and strong, which is very rare, actually. He always talked about the figure as a future event, which is pretty standard for a lot of the big polygamous groups, I would say.
Another interesting thing about this community, which we'll just start calling it the FLDS, even though the formal name is still coming, is that they didn't really do any proselyting. The few converts they made were usually from the LDS Church or other fundamentalist groups. Remember that idea because it will come up later in the series. Another piece of FLDS identity is the lack of temple ordinances in the group. While it's true that Joseph White Musser apparently began administering these rituals to a select group, this occurred after the priesthood split. So while the AUB and other associated groups have a tradition of endowments and second anointings, the FLDS strand of fundamentalism didn't emphasize this.
As Leroy Johnson grew older, members of the priesthood council began to die off. Johnson didn't replace them, which leads to an increasingly concentrated group there. As Johnson's health declined in the late 70s, a split starts brewing again. While Rule and Jeffs maintained a public position of loyalty to Leroy Johnson, the other council members, guys like Feisty Marion Hammond and Alma Timpson, started to rebel. Using Joseph Smith's language about Sidney Rigdon, Uncle Roy told his followers that he was throwing Hammond and Timpson off his back and dismissed them from the council. A second group formed out of this split, and they began construction of a community just down the road. With the dedication of a chapel on September 27, 1986, on the 100th anniversary of John Taylor's revelation, Centennial Park was born.
And here's how you can tell if FLDS from LDS. I had an uncle, Leroy. We called him Leroy, not Leroy. But in the crick, I've had to practice Leroy. Leroy Johnson died 2 months later, and Rule and Jeffs took over leadership. Any semblance of council leadership that had remained under Uncle Roy was gone. Rulin would oversee the church with a much tighter grip than Roy. And the transition from Uncle Roy, who, while certainly part and parcel of problematic elements of FLDS life, was almost universally beloved, to Rule and Jeffs, who did not enjoy the community outpouring of love. That was noticeable. And this will put us in a perfect place to dive into the series. So hopefully this gave you a good primer for what we're about to talk about. And we're going to be a little bit busy for the next few weeks because Sunstone Symposium is going to be next week, July 27th through the 30th. We want to see you there if you're listening and you're in Salt Lake City or in the area. Why haven't you bought your ticket yet? It's the best way to support Sunstone. Brian, Christina, and I are going to be there along with a lot of the guests we've had on the podcast. Lots of cool history presentations. We have a great presentation this year where King Benjamin, the TikTok star and comedian who grew up in the AUB, is going to come do his amazing comedy set at Broovies for us. We have the stars from Under the Banner of Heaven, Tyner Rushing and Scott Campbell, who played Emma and Brigham, are going to come and give a presentation. We have the billionaire who resigned from the LDS Church, Jeff Green, who's going to talk about his experiences. Lots of really cool stuff happening. So join us. Go to sunstone.org. Buy your ticket today.
Have you ever been close to tragedy? Been close to folks who have? Have you ever felt a Books of Mormon's report so powerful, so heavy you collapse? It's the Books of Mormon's report, brought to you by Benchmark Books. It's no secret by now, I find the Manifesto to Second Manifesto pipeline unendingly fascinating. So, here are my three recommendations on this period. First, Solemn Covenant, the Mormon Polygamous Passage by Carmen Hardy. published by University of Illinois Press. It doesn't hurt that Carmen was one of the best souls ever. His book was pretty amazing, too. I've just recently had Robot Voice play it to me on during my drive and reminded myself how fantastic this book is. Meticulous research draws out these various nooks and crannies from the Wilford Woodruff Manifesto through the Second Manifesto and then to the Great Confusion thereafter. His Lying for the Lord essay is also a true classic. This book usually scraps and claws around in my brain because it is sometimes my all-time favorite of Mormon history. Next are two more recent contributions. First, Modern Polygamy and Mormon Fundamentalism, The Generations After the Manifesto, from Brian Hales, published by Greg Cofer Books. Say what you will about Mr. Brian Hales, that man does his research. And when he wrote that book, he was blazing new trails for the most part, particularly the more recent history, and that's always laudable when you're the trailblazer there. Even more recently, American Polygamy, A History of Fundamentalist Mormon Faith by Craig Foster and Marianne Watson, published by The History Press. This is a very concise overview of the origins and growth of the fundamentalist movement with some very good special insight into the AUB. Also, if you're prone to complain about the lack of pictures in Mormon history, you will love this book because there are numerous incredible photos, many from their own collection. As always, you can pick up these books and everything else you need in the Mormon universe from Benchmark Books. Visit Benchmark in Salt Lake City or at benchmarkbooks.com.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by artist Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com and consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.